Chapter 20. Evidently I've slept. The sun is hot. My watch says a few minutes before noon. I look over the rock I'm leaning against and see Chris sound asleep on the other side. Way up above him, the forest stops, and barren gray rock leads into patches of snow. We can climb the back of this ridge straight up there, but it would be dangerous toward the top. I look up at the top of the mountain for a while. What was it Chris said I told him last night? I'll see you at the top of the mountain? No, I'll meet you at the top of the mountain. How could I meet him at the top of the mountain when I'm already with him? Something's very strange about that. He said I told him something else, too, the other night, that it's lonely here. That contradicts what I actually believe. I don't think it's lonely here at all. A sound of falling rock draws my attention over to one side of the mountain. Nothing moves, completely still. It's all right. You hear little rock slides like this all the time. Not so little sometimes, though. Avalanches start with little slides like that. If you're above them or beside them, they're interesting to watch. But if they're above you, no help then. You just have to watch it come. People say strange things in their sleep, but why would I tell him I'll meet him? And why would he think I was awake? There's something really wrong here that produces a very bad quality feeling, but I don't know what it is. First you get the feeling, then you figure out why. I hear Chris move and turn and see him look around. Where are we? He asks. Top of the ridge. Oh, he says. He smiles. I break open a lunch of Swiss cheese, pepperoni, and crackers. I cut up the cheese and then the pepperoni in careful, neat slices. The silence allows you to do each thing right. Let's build a cabin here, he says. Oh, I groan. And climb up to it every day? Sure. He teases. That wasn't hard. Yesterday is long ago in his memory. I pass some cheese and crackers over to him. What are you always thinking about? He asks. Thousands of things, I answer. What? Most of them wouldn't make any sense to you. Like what? Like why I told you I'd meet you at the top of the mountain. Oh, he says and looks down. You said I sounded drunk, I tell him. No, not drunk, he says, still looking down. The way he looks away from me makes me wonder all over again if he's telling the truth. How then? He doesn't answer. How then, Chris? Just different. How? Well, I don't know. He looks up at me, and there's a flicker of fear. Like he used to sound a long time ago, he says, and then looks down. When? When we lived here. I keep my face composed so that he sees no change of expression in it, then carefully get up and go over and methodically turn the socks on the rock. They've dried long ago. As I return with them, I see his glance is still on me. Casually, I say, I didn't know I sounded different. He doesn't reply to this. I put the socks on and slip the boots over them. I'm thirsty, Chris says. We shouldn't have too far to go down to find water, I say, standing up. I look at the snow for a while, then say, You ready to go? He nods and we get the packs on. As we walk along the summit toward the beginning of a ravine, we hear another clattering sound of falling rock, much louder than the first one I heard just a while ago. I look up to see where it is. Still nothing. What was that? Chris asks. Rock slide. We both stand still for a moment, listening. Chris asks, Is there somebody up there? No, I think it's just melting snow that's loosening stones. When it's really hot like this in the early part of the summer, you hear a lot of small rock slides. sometimes big ones. It's part of the wearing down of the mountains. I didn't know mountains wore out. Not wore out, wore down. They get rounded and gentle. These mountains are still unworn. Everywhere around us now, except above, the sides of the mountain are covered with blackish green of the forest. In the distance, the forest looks like velvet. I say, you look at these mountains now, and they look so permanent and peaceful, but they're changing all the time, and the changes aren't always peaceful. Beneath us here, right now, there are forces that can tear this whole mountain apart.
Do they ever?
Ever what?
Tear the whole mountain apart.
Yes, I say. Then I remember. Not far from here, there are 19 people lying dead under millions of tons of rock. Everyone was amazed there were only 19.
What happened?
They were just tourists from the east who had stopped for a night at a campground. During the night, the underground forces broke free, and when the rescuers saw what had happened the next morning, they just shook their heads. They didn't even try to excavate. All they could have done was dig down through hundreds of feet of rock for bodies that would just have to be buried all over again. So they left them there. They're still there now.
How did they know there were 19?
Neighbors and relatives from their hometowns reported them missing. Chris stares at the top of the mountain before us.
Didn't they get any warning?
I don't know.
You would think there'd be a warning.
Maybe there was. We walk to where the ridge we are on creases inward to the start of a ravine. I see that we can follow this ravine down and eventually find water in it. I start angling down now. Some more rocks clatter above us. Suddenly I'm frightened. Chris, I say.
What?
You know what I think?
No, what?
I think we'd be very smart if we let that mountaintop go for now and tried another summer. He's silent, then he says,
why?
I have bad feelings about it. He doesn't say anything for a long time. Finally he says,
like what?
Oh, I just think that we could get caught up there in a storm or a slide or something, and we'd be in real trouble. More silence. I look up and see real disappointment in his face. I think he knows I'm leaving something out. Why don't you think about it, I say, and then, when we get to some water and have lunch, we'll decide. We continue walking down. Okay, I say. He finally says, okay, in a noncommittal voice. The descent is easy now, but I see it will be steeper soon. It's still open and sunny here, but soon we'll be in trees again. I don't know what to make of all this weird talk at night, except that it's not good, for either of us. It sounds like all the strain of this cycling and camping and Chautauqua and all these old places is a bad effect on me that appears at night. I want to clear out of here as fast as possible. I don't suppose that sounds like the old days to Chris, either. I spook very easily these days, and am not ashamed to admit it. He never spooked at anything. Never. That's the difference between us. That's why I'm alive and he's not. If he's up there, some psychic entity, some ghost, some doppelganger, waiting up there for us in God knows what fashion, well, he's going to have to wait a long time. A very long time. These damned heights get eerie after a while. I want to go down, way down, far, far down, to the ocean. That sounds right. Where the waves roll in slowly, and there's always a roar, and you can't fall anywhere. You're already there. Now we enter the trees again, and the side of the mountaintop is obscured by their branches, and I'm glad. I think we've gone as far along Phaedrus's path as we want to go in this Chautauqua, too. I want to leave his path now. I've given him all due credit for what he thought and said and wrote, and now I want to develop on my own some of the ideas he neglected to pursue. The title of this Chautauqua is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, not Zen and the Art of Mountain Climbing. And there are no motorcycles on the tops of mountains, and in my opinion, very little Zen. Zen is the spirit of the valley, not the mountaintop. The only Zen you find on the tops of mountains is the Zen you bring up there. Let's get out of here. Feels good to be going down, doesn't it? I say. No answer. We're going to have a little fight, I'm afraid. You go up the mountaintop, and all you're going to get is a great big heavy stone tablet handed to you with a bunch of rules on it. That's about what happened to him. Thought he was a goddamn messiah. Not me, boy. The hours are way too long and the pay is way too short. Let's go, let's go. Soon I'm clomping down the slope in a kind of two-step idiot gallop. Gadump, gadump, gadump. Until I hear Chris holler, "Slow down!" And he is a couple of hundred yards back through the trees. So I slow down, but after a while, see he is deliberately lagging behind. He's disappointed, of course. I suppose what I ought to do in the Chautauqua is just point out in summary form the direction Phaedrus went, without evaluation, and then get on with my own thing. Believe me, when the world is not seen as a duality of mind and matter, but as a trinity of quality mind and matter, then the art of motorcycle maintenance and other arts take on a dimension of meaning they never had. The specter of technology the Sutherlands are running from becomes not an evil, but a positive, fun thing. And to demonstrate that will be a long, fun task. But first, to give this other specter his walking papers, I should say the following. Perhaps he would have gone in the direction I'm now about to go in if this second wave of crystallization, the metaphysical wave, had finally grounded out where I'll be grounding it out, that is, in the everyday world. I think metaphysics is good if it improves everyday life. Otherwise, forget it. But unfortunately for him, it didn't ground out. It went into a third mystical wave of crystallization, from which he never recovered. He'd been speculating about the relationship of quality to mind and matter, and had identified quality as the parent of mind and matter, that event which gives birth to mind and matter. This Copernican inversion of the relationship of quality to the objective world could sound mysterious if not carefully explained. But he didn't mean it to be mysterious. He simply meant that at the cutting edge of time, before an object can be distinguished, there must be a kind of non-intellectual awareness, which he called awareness of quality. You can't be aware that you've seen a tree until after you've seen the tree, and between the instant of vision and instant of awareness, there must be a time lag. We sometimes think of that time lag as unimportant. But there's no justification for thinking that the time lag is unimportant. None whatsoever. The past exists only in our memories, the future only in our plans. The present is our only reality. The tree that you are aware of intellectually, because of that small time lag, is always in the past and therefore is always unreal. Any intellectually conceived object is always in the past and therefore unreal. Reality is always the moment of vision before the intellectualization takes place. There is no other reality. This pre-intellectual reality is what Phaedrus felt he had properly identified as quality. Since all intellectually identifiable things must emerge from this pre-intellectual reality, quality is the parent, the source of all subjects and objects. He felt that intellectuals usually have the greatest trouble seeing this quality, precisely because they are so swift and absolute about snapping everything into intellectual form. The ones who have the easiest time seeing this quality are small children, uneducated people, and culturally deprived people. These have the least predisposition toward intellectuality from cultural sources and have the least formal training to instill it further into them. That, he felt, is why squareness is such a uniquely intellectual disease. He felt he'd been accidentally immunized from it, or at least to some extent broken from the habit, by his failure from school. After that, he felt no compulsive identification with intellectuality, and could examine anti-intellectual doctrines with sympathy. Squares, he said, because of their prejudices toward intellectuality, usually regard quality, the pre-intellectual reality, as unimportant, a mere uneventful transition period between objective reality and subjective perception of it. Because they have preconceived ideas of its unimportance, they don't seek to find out if it's in any way different from their intellectual conception of it. It is different, he said. Once you begin to hear the sound of that quality, see that Korean wall, that non-intellectual reality in its pure form, you want to forget all that word stuff, which you finally begin to see is always somewhere else. Now, armed with his new time-interrelated metaphysical trinity, he had that romantic classic quality split, the one which had threatened to ruin him, completely stopped. They couldn't cut up quality now. He could sit there and at his leisure cut them up. Romantic quality always correlated with instantaneous impressions. Square quality always involved multiple considerations that extended over a period of time. Romantic quality was the present, the here and now of things. Classic quality was always concerned with more than just the present. The relation of the present to the past and future was always considered. If you conceived the past and future to be all contained in the present, well, that was groovy. The present was what you lived for. And if your motorcycle is working, why worry about it? But if you consider the present to be merely an instant between the past and the future, just a passing moment, then to neglect the past and future for the present is bad quality indeed. The motorcycle may be working now, but when was the oil level last checked? Fuss budgetary from the romantic view, but good common sense from the classic. Now we had two different kinds of quality, but they no longer split quality itself. They were just two different time aspects of quality, short and long. Previously been asked for was a metaphysical hierarchy that looked like this. Reality, as a sum of subjective, mental, and objective, physical. Subjective, as a sum of classical, intellectual, quality Phaedrus should be teaching, and romantic, emotional, quality Phaedrus was teaching. What he gave them in return was a metaphysical hierarchy that looked like this. Quality, reality, as a sum of romantic quality, pre-intellectual reality, and classical quality, intellectual reality. Classical quality, as a sum of subjective reality, mind, and objective reality, matter. The quality he was teaching was not just a part of reality, it was the whole thing. He then proceeded in terms of the Trinity to answer the question, why does everybody see quality differently? This was the question he had always had to answer speciously before. Now he said, quality is shapeless, formless, indescribable. To see shapes and forms is to intellectualize.
Quality is independent of any such shapes and forms. The names, the shapes, and forms we give quality depend only partly on the quality. They also depend partly on the a priori images we have accumulated in our memory. We constantly seek to find, in the quality event, analogues to our previous experiences. If we didn't, we'd be unable to act. We build up our language in terms of these analogues. We build up our whole culture in terms of these analogues. The reason people see quality differently, he said, is because they come to it with different sets of analogues. He gave linguistic examples, showing that to us the Hindi letters da, 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 and da, dha all sound identical to us because we don't have analogues to them to sensitize us to their differences. Similarly, most Hindi-speaking people cannot distinguish between da, da, and the, the, because they are not so sensitized. It is not uncommon, he said, for Indian villagers to see ghosts, but they have a terrible time seeing the law of gravity. This, he said, explains why a class full of freshman composition students arrives at similar ratings of quality in the compositions. They all have relatively similar backgrounds and similar knowledge. But if a group of foreign students were brought in, or, say, medieval poems out of the range of class experience were brought in, then the student's ability to rank quality would probably not correlate as well. In a sense, he said, it's the student's choice of quality that defines him. People differ about quality not because quality is different, but because people are different in terms of experience. He speculated that if two people had identical a priori analogues, they would see quality identically every time. There was no way to test this, however, so it had to remain just speculation. In answer to his colleagues at school, he wrote, "Any philosophic explanation of quality is going to be both false and true precisely because it is a philosophic explanation. The process of philosophic explanation is an analytic process, a process of breaking something down into subjects and predicates. What I mean, and everybody else means, by the word quality cannot be broken down into subjects and predicates. This is not because quality is so mysterious, but because quality is so simple, immediate, and direct." The easiest intellectual analog of pure quality that people in our environment can understand is that quality is the response of an organism to its environment. He used this example because his chief questioners seemed to see things in terms of stimulus-response behavior theory. An amoeba placed on a plate of water with a drip of dilute sulfuric acid placed nearby will pull away from the acid, I think. If it could speak, the amoeba, without knowing anything about sulfuric acid, could say, "This environment has poor quality." If it had a nervous system, it would act in a much more complex way to overcome the poor quality of the environment. It would seek analogs, that is, images and symbols from its previous experience to define the unpleasant nature of its new environment and thus understand it. In our highly complex organic state, we advanced organisms respond to our environment with an invention of many marvelous analogs. We invent earth and heavens, trees, stones, and oceans, gods, music, arts, language, philosophy, engineering, civilization, and science. We call all these analogs reality, and they are reality. We mesmerize our children in the name of truth into knowing that they are reality. We throw anyone who does not accept these analogs into an insane asylum. But that which causes us to invent the analogs is quality. Quality is the continuing stimulus which our environment puts upon us to create the world in which we live. All of it. Every last bit of it. Now, to take that which has caused us to create the world and include it within the world we have created is clearly impossible. That is why quality cannot be defined. If we do define it, we are defining something less than quality itself. I remember this fragment more vividly than any of the others, possibly because it is the most important of all. When he wrote it, he felt momentary fright and was about to strike out the words, "all of it," every last bit of it. Madness there. I think he saw it. But he couldn't see any logical reason to strike these words out, and it was too late now for faint-heartedness. He ignored his warning and let the words stand. He put his pencil down and then felt something let go, as though something internal had been strained too hard and had given way. Then it was too late. He began to see that he had shifted away from his original stand. He was no longer talking about a metaphysical trinity, but an absolute monism. Quality was the source and substance of everything. A whole new flood of philosophic associations came to mind. Hegel had talked like this with his absolute mind. Absolute mind was independent too, both of objectivity and subjectivity. However, Hegel said the absolute mind was the source of everything, but then excluded romantic experience from the everything it was the source of. Hegel's absolute was completely classical, completely rational, and completely orderly. Quality was not like that. Phaedrus remembered Hegel had been regarded as a bridge between Western and Oriental philosophy. The Vedanta of the Hindus, the way of the Taoists, even the Buddha had been described as an absolute monism, similar to Hegel's philosophy. Phaedrus doubted at the time, however, whether mystical ones and metaphysical monisms were introconvertible, since mystical ones follow no rules and metaphysical monisms do. Quality was a metaphysical entity, not a mystic one. Or was it? What was the difference? He answered himself that the difference was one of definition. Metaphysical entities are defined. Mystical ones are not. That made quality mystical. No, it was really both. Although he thought of it purely in philosophical terms up to now as metaphysical, he had all along refused to define it. That made it mystic, too. Its indefinability freed it from the rules of metaphysics. Then, on impulse, Phaedrus went over to his bookshelf and picked out a small blue cardboard-bound book. He'd hand-copied this book and bound it himself years before when he couldn't find a copy for sale anywhere. It was the 2,400-year-old Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu. He began to read through the lines he had read many times before, but this time he studied it to see if a certain substitution would work. He began to read and interpret it at the same time. He read, "The quality that can be defined is not the absolute quality." That was what he had said. "The names that can be given it are not absolute names. It is the origin of heaven and earth. When named, it is the mother of all things." Exactly. Quality, romantic quality, and its manifestations, classic quality, are in their nature the same. It is given different names, subjects and objects, when it becomes classically manifest. Romantic quality and classic quality together may be called the mystic. Reaching from mystery into deeper mystery, it is the gate to the secret of all life. Quality is all-pervading, and its use is inexhaustible, fathomless, like the fountainhead of all things. Yet crystal clear like water it seems to remain. I do not know whose son it is, an image of what existed before God. Continuously, continuously, it seems to remain. Draw upon it, and it serves you with ease. Looked at, but cannot be seen, listened to, but cannot be heard, grasped at, but cannot be touched. These three elude all our inquiries, and hence blend and become one. Not by its rising is there light, not by its sinking is there darkness. Unceasing, continuous, it cannot be defined, and reverts again into the realm of nothingness. That is why it is called the form of the formless, the image of nothingness. That is why it is called elusive. Meet it, and you do not see its face. Follow it, and you do not see its back. He who holds fast to the quality of old is able to know the primeval beginnings, which are the continuity of quality. Phaedrus read on through line after line, verse after verse of this, watched them match, fit, slip into place. Exactly. This was what he meant. This was what he'd been saying all along, only poorly, mechanistically. There was nothing vague or inexact about this book. It was as precise and definite as it could be. It was what he had been saying, only in a different language with different roots and origins. He was from another valley, seeing what was in this valley, not now as a story told by strangers, but as a part of the valley he was from. He was seeing it all. He had broken the code. He read on, line after line, page after page. Not a discrepancy. What he had been talking about all the time as quality was here the Tao, the great central generating force of all religions, Oriental and Occidental, past and present, all knowledge, everything. Then his mind's eye looked up and caught his own image and realized where he was and what he was seeing, and I don't know what really happened, but now the slippage that Phaedrus had felt earlier, the internal parting of his mind, suddenly gathered momentum, as do the rocks at the top of a mountain. Before he could stop it, the sudden accumulated mass of awareness began to grow and grow into an avalanche of thought and awareness, out of control. With each additional growth of the downward tearing mass loosening hundreds of times its volume, and then that mass uprooting hundreds of times its volume more, and then hundreds of times that. On and on, wider and broader, until there was nothing left to stand. No more anything. It all gave way from under him.